Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff, on this program that we bring to you every week, dealing with the economic dimensions of our lives, what we pay, what we earn, the taxes we face. And actually, let me say a word about taxes. We're at tax time, so we're going to spend a little time on taxes this week and next to fill in some of the mystery and overcome some of the blank notes in the regular media's coverage. As your host, I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I teach now at the New School University in New York City. I also write regular economic commentaries for a variety of publications, but particularly for truthout.org. That is an independent and courageous source of news and analysis every day, and I urge you to check them out at truthout.org. And as I say each week, if you're interested in the kinds of programs that we produce, in the analyses you hear, in the arguments that we bring forward, then please make use of our two websites that are designed to feed exactly that kind of interest, to provide you with links and connections and articles and interviews, an enormous treasure trove, we hope, of information that's updated literally every day. The first one is rdwolf2fs.com, and the other one is democracyatwork.info. Not only do they have all this material that I've just described, but these two websites also offer you two other interesting opportunities. The first is to communicate with us, to send us questions that we will consider for answering on the program, to send us your suggestions, your criticisms, what you like and don't like about the program. We read every single email and use them in designing each program that we produce. And the second thing you can do is follow us, if you're interested, on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Just click on the icon on either of the websites, and you will be provided with that kind of ongoing relationship. To begin today's economic updates, I want to talk about the noted TV personality Bill O'Reilly. He recently said on television that he was angry at the new mayor of New York City, Mr. de Blasio, and wanted to punch him. Well, that's what he said, because he taxes wealthy people, and that this was some sort of punishment for the fact that they were wealthy. And I wanted to remind Mr. de Blasio and Mr. O'Reilly that taxing wealthy people at a higher rate that we tax others has been a principle of the federal income tax for at least a century. Perhaps Bill didn't know that, but it's established in American law. It has been endorsed by Republican and Democratic presidents and Congresses alike for a very long time. The principle is simply that if you have more, if the country that you live in has helped you, as it has everybody, to become rich, if you're lucky enough to be rich, then you have a responsibility that goes with the wealth you enjoy. Bill O'Reilly may not like it, but it has been the normal custom here in the United States. Oh, and another little fact. January of this year, Bill O'Reilly purchased a home on Montauk, the end of Long Island, where he paid in excess of $6 million. He's very upset about the taxes he has to pay. As a rich person, he perhaps has a standing to raise that question that other people who can't buy homes for millions of dollars don't have. The other economic update I wanted to bring to your attention today has to do with the reports in the press over the last week that Greece, that beleaguered country in Europe that we've talked about on many occasions, is supposed to be in better shape, and the evidence for that is that they are returning to the bond market to borrow money. I find it bizarre to say that a country which already has debts it cannot manage and is now going into the bond market to borrow still more, that this should be looked upon as a sign of health. It shouldn't be, because it isn't. Let's review what it is that a government does when it borrows money. A government borrows money when the amount of it taxes it takes in are not enough to pay for the goods and services it provides to its citizens. Now, what's remarkable in Greece is that over the last 6 years, the government has drastically slashed the quantity of goods and services it provides to its people, a staggering amount for that relatively small economy. So you might decide that it's time to solve the economic problems of the government by taxing those who haven't been damaged, not the unemployed who've suffered enough, not all the public services and servants who've been slashed enough. No, you might finally want to do something that governments everywhere could do if they wanted to pay for the things governments ought to do, but not borrow money. And the way you do that is to tax those who have it. The very progressive tax structure that Bill O'Reilly finds so burdensome. You tax corporations and you tax the rich. And that way you raise the money that the government needs without requiring the government to borrow. If you don't want governments to borrow, if you don't want deficits, then go where the money is, tax it, and that solves your problem. Here's a little footnote for you to think about in light of this issue. Here's where it goes. When the government doesn't tax corporations and the rich and is confronted by the need to pay for the goods and services everybody wants, guess where the government goes to borrow the money it has to borrow because it won't tax corporations and the rich? Well, if you studied economics, you know the answer. Governments go to corporations and the rich to borrow. So let's review. By corporations and the rich pressing on politicians not to tax them, they force those politicians to borrow. And they force them, in fact, to borrow from corporations and the rich, who therefore have every incentive to continue this nice arrangement, refusing to pay taxes, and instead of having that money taken from them in taxes, provide a loan to the government, which the government has to pay back and pay them interest while they wait. Strange arrangement for managing your public affairs. I want to turn next to another beleaguered reality in our society, and that is the city of Detroit, a kind of emblem of what is troubling the American economy and the failure to come up with a way of dealing with it. But I want to start in an unusual place. I want to start with sports. Over the last couple of weeks, there's been a lot of news about Miguel Cabrera, a stunningly powerful and effective baseball player playing for the Detroit Tigers, and who has just won a contract for the next 10 years worth over $300 million. Detroit, a society, a city in extreme economic decline. Just to remind you, 1960, the population of Detroit, nearly 2 million. Today, the population of Detroit, 700,000. No jobs, houses abandoned, a collapsed society, a failed society. And why? Because large corporations, particularly the automobile industry, decided they could make more profit someplace else, thereby wrecking the lives of literally millions of people. So where are they now? They're bankrupt. They've declared bankruptcy as a city. They're trying desperately to avoid the further collapse of an already broken city. And they need every penny they can get to try to rebuild the society. And they chose, in their wisdom, to pay $300 million to an individual baseball player. Now, I don't want to single out Miguel Cabrera. He's no less deserving than all the other baseball players who have gotten multi-million dollar contracts. But it does tell you something about the society. And in Detroit, it's doubly impressive because last year, city and state money was not used to help rebuild Detroit, but instead given as a subsidy to the Detroit Red Wings hockey team. Now, I know the arguments that the teams make. This is good for economic development, building a sports arena for hockey, paying for a glitzy baseball player. Sure, it'll bring some business to Detroit, but that's never the real issue. The real issue is, What would have been a better use for $300 and $400 million? To rebuild the city's infrastructure, which has collapsed? To do something about the abandoned housing? To provide jobs to people to rebuild the city? You think you couldn't have done better with $700 million than to provide a subsidy to a hockey team and an outrageous salary to an individual player? Nobody in their right mind would make that argument unless they were paid to do so. Last thing about Detroit. Also in the news last week, as they go about desperately trying to cope with their collapsed, bankrupt city, bankrupt in the wake of corporate decisions to move production elsewhere to have higher profits, two other things caught my attention. First, they are busy looking for ways to sell the art holdings of the Detroit Museum, which include, for example, the world-famous murals done by Diego Rivera, probably the most famous artist to come out of Mexico in the last 150 years. What an amazing thing to get rid of their art. And here was one of the arguments, and for me this was the peak of it all. One of the arguments made for why they ought to sell the art, because in the bankruptcy, one of the victims is going to be retired workers. Police, fire, school teachers, clerks, who gave a lifetime of work to Detroit and now are retired and rely on the retirements that they contributed to all those years. These folks are now being told that under the pain of bankruptcy, it is likely that their retirement incomes will be cut, leaving them, and this is the point I want you to understand, leaving them below the poverty line in the United States. So the argument was made, sell the artwork so a fund could be established that could help out those families left below the poverty line to lift them up to the poverty line. My goodness. In the United States, this is what passes for urban planning and urban economics. The next update has to do with tax season. Here we are in tax season. Those of us who haven't finished our tax preparations are doing so to pay for our income tax bills at the federal level. So I wanted to go over so we all know what the federal income tax situation is and how it's changed over recent years. A little reminder as we face our own tax day, our tax bill, how it looks from the government as a whole. The largest single source of money that the federal government lives off of is the personal income tax. 47% in 2013, the last year that we have numbers for, 47% of the government's revenue came from the income tax. And that is a progressive tax. That is, it takes a higher percentage of your income the wealthier you are. It doesn't take from the richest people anything like what it used to take in the 50s or 60s or 70s. The tax rates were much higher. 91% in the 50s and 60s, 70% in the 1970s. Today, 39%. Rich people have enjoyed a remarkable cut in their personal income tax. But a little less than half of the federal government's money comes from the progressive personal income tax. The next big item is the payroll tax. The money that is taken out of your pay for Social Security, Medicare, unemployment compensation, things like that. That accounts for 34%. So clearly, those two big items, they're the way the government, the federal government, lives. 47% from the personal income tax, 34% from the payroll tax. That takes care of four-fifths of the total budget tax side of the federal government. What is the corporate income tax, the tax that companies have to pay? How much of the federal government's income comes from taxing corporations in 2013? 10%. Taxing individuals? 47 plus 34. Over 80% of the federal government's money is taxing individuals. 10% is taxing corporations. And you know what the rest is? Excise taxes, the taxes you pay for alcohol, for gasoline, for cigarettes. The estate tax, we exempt the first $10.5 million that a family can earn these days from the estate tax, which means most of you listening to me really have very little to worry about on that score, do you? So, has it always been this way? Answer, not at all. I'm going to take you only back a half century, 50 years ago. What was the story 50 years ago with the federal government? Well, here's what was interesting. The amount of the federal government's income that they got from personal income taxes was about the same 50 years ago, a little under half. 47% today, in that neighborhood 50 years ago. What about the corporate income tax? That's really interesting. 50 years ago, the corporate income tax was as big as the personal income tax. That is, 40-something percent of the federal government's money came from the personal income tax, 40-something percent came from the corporate income tax. Over the last 40 years, the federal government relieved corporations of their tax burden, reduced it from 40% of what the government takes in to merely 10%. And what filled in the gap? You guessed it, the payroll tax. We shifted the burden of taxation in this country over the last 50 years from the backs of the corporation onto the backs of, well, let me say it honestly, you, my listeners, my viewers. We shifted it from business to individuals. So the next time you hear a politician say, we have a problem with taxes in this country, yeah, we do. But the problem isn't that they're too high or too low. The problem is they got shifted from business to you. And part of the struggle we have, if we're going to be honest, is to question why that ever happened and then to think about going back to the way it was back in the 50s and 60s, when not only did corporations pay much higher tax, but we had less unemployment than we had today and more rapid economic growth than we had today. Hint, hint, hint. Okay, I have more economic updates, but I don't have enough time. So I want to turn now and introduce you to my guest. She is Nomi Prince. She is a person I have known for quite a while, and I think you're going to find very interesting what she has to say. She is a journalist, a speaker, a respected TV and radio commentator. But she's also something quite interesting. She's a former executive in several Wall Street firms, including Goldman Sachs and Bear Stearns. I think that qualifies her to be exceptionally well-versed in the kinds of topics we're going to be dealing with today, which have particularly to do with bankers and presidents and the relationships between them. She has written several books, Our Other People's Money and It Takes a Pillage. Her writing has also been featured in the New York Times, Fortune Magazine, Mother Jones, The Guardian, the British newspaper, The Nation Magazine, and other publications. She's also a senior fellow at the Demos Foundation that's based in New York. I want, for those of you who could see us, to also show her latest book, which is really what we're going to concentrate on today, and it's called All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. Nomi Prince, welcome very much to today's program.
Oh, thanks very much, Rick, and it's good to see you again.
Yes, I think we have done this before.
Yes, we cross coasts.
Right. Let me jump right off. Tell us a little bit about the work you did that went into this book. Tell us a little bit about the history of our own society here in the United States in the relationship between bankers and presidents, between the financial power and the political leadership.
First off, what I did to research this book is I went across all of the presidential libraries, their archives throughout the country to examine the original documents, the letters, the correspondence, the phone conversations that occurred between presidents and the key bankers, the most powerful bankers that were around during their terms. So that's sort of where the story came out from and where the research started. In terms of the idea for the book, actually I had a novel out in between some of those books most recently called Black Tuesday. And Black Tuesday, it was a romantic historical fiction, but it took place around the crash in 1929. And there is a scene in it, a couple chapters in it actually, where I researched more peripherally a meeting that took place at the Morgan Bank, which was called the House of Morgan at the time, on October 24th, Thursday afternoon, actually at noon, where a bunch of bankers, six in total, the big six of the time, got together and decided that the markets were plummeting all around them and they needed to do something to save the markets and therefore to save themselves. And it turned out that those six bankers, and the meeting was chaired by a banker named Thomas Lamont, who was the acting chairman of the Morgan Bank, because Jack Morgan was over in Europe doing other things, were really had incredible through lines going back in history to the turn of the 20th century, the early 1900s, and through today. And the families and the banks that were represented in that room and the way in which they operated had social and political and cultural and power connections and family relationships to all of the presidents in some capacity along the way, sometimes stronger, sometimes weaker, but always present in all of the presidential archives that I visited.
Tell us a little bit about those linkages. In other words, what has been, a lot of our listeners want to know, what exactly is the power of the banker over what happens politically? In other words, are our presidents representatives of all of us, or are they in a particular and special relationship to bankers with its family and other dimensions? Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, certainly in the period I looked at, and I was very specific, again, to connect going backwards from 1929, but also to look at a period in history where this relationship that we have, and it's not bankers over presidents, it's not money over politics. They are symbiotic. They are side by side.
Partners, you might
they,
say.
They are partners. In fact, I think it was Mark Carlin at Truth Out coined the term, they have a co-presidency. and he said that bankers are like the vice president of the United States. And I had a lot of readers say, no, they're really the president. But the point is that there is a symbiotic relationship. And today it's a little different. But going back to the early 1900s, there was a bank panic in 1907 that started, as many do, in the markets here in New York. And it was occurred because of a bet gone wrong in copper. A bunch of guys decided to rig the markets. Rigging the markets, big term out nowadays, but had been happening all throughout sort of financial history. But in particular, they made a lot of bad bets about copper. They went wrong, and they came down amongst people who had money at the companies in which these bets permeated. One of them was called the Knickerbocker Trust Company. It was a company in New York. It had branches from Fifth Avenue to Harlem, which is basically a cover the gamut of very wealthy customers to poorer customers. It really served a lot of different types of people, and it was about to go under. Teddy Roosevelt was concerned about this, so he didn't throw his Treasury Secretary or even anything into New York to do something. He got in touch with J.P. Morgan and asked for J.P. Morgan to handle the situation. So J.P. Morgan was thrilled about this because it turned out he got $25 million from the Treasury Department to sort of play with to decide how to plug the holes wherever he wanted to plug them. And he also called a meeting in his library in his home of his banker friends, of which one was Tom Lamont, who I mentioned before, a young guy at the time, but a lot of different banker friends who were powerful at the time. And he said, you guys all got to pony up some money so that we can save some of these companies, so that we can fix things here in the markets. What he also did was he asked a friend of his, James Stillman, who happened to be running the National City Bank, which is now Citigroup, if he could help raise some money too. James Stillman turned around and asked the Rockefellers if they could liquidate some oil shares to give him. So all of this fuss was going around, and Teddy Roosevelt was waiting in Washington for word, basically. There was a midnight meeting a couple days later at the Hotel Manhattan, where Morgan was there and James Stillman came, and James Stillman's number two, Frank Vanderlip, came, and all these guys got together, and the Treasury Secretary was sort of elsewhere waiting to see what they were going to do. They talked about this money. The press was there. The press exalted the next morning. The Treasury Secretary the next morning said everything is saved. They didn't save the Knickerbocker Trust Company. What they saved was the Trust Company of America. The Trust Company of America happened to have ties to all of those bankers. They happened to have had personal and financial interests in that bank. So they took some of the government's money, not as much as we've seen very recently, a lot of their own money, which they got from liquidating shares in other operations, to basically save their friend. And that's what they did. They plugged the holes. Teddy Roosevelt was happy later on. He wrote in his memoirs how a catastrophe had been averted. And this started a relationship on the political financial basis. But it was also because they knew each other personally, Theodore Roosevelt and J.P. Morgan and a lot of these individuals. They trusted each other to take care of things. In particular, Teddy Roosevelt trusted J.P. Morgan to do something. So when Teddy Roosevelt became a big trust buster in terms of how we know him historically, he never busted the banks. And so that period really cemented a lot of things that happened from then on. On a personal basis, many families that were connected to that event, the Morgans, the Stillmans, we can talk about some more of the rest of the families, but basically evolved to work with presidents from that time to also dictate more policy, not just financial policy. They helped establish the Federal Reserve, but they also helped finance World War I. They pushed Woodrow Wilson from a position of neutrality sooner than he might have otherwise been pushed into a position of supporting the Allies because they could make money financing them because they were their friends. And that's kind of how it all started, and it evolved in different ways throughout the decades. Sometimes those personal relationships worked for the betterment of an America, which, as you mentioned, during the time where taxes were more equal, for example, between corporations and individuals, and there was an alliance that worked, and a lot of times it didn't work.
I'm fascinated for several reasons, and I'm sort of excited at the ways we can take this conversation. But let me give you a couple and ask for your response. Some people, economists in particular, believe that only in the last 30 or 40 years have we had something called the financialization of the world economy, and that only therefore in the last 20 or 30 years have big bankers, the core and the center of the financial part of our society, had the kind of political and economic power. What your research seems to show is that it's much older than that. It really isn't a matter of the last 30 years or of the growth of the financial sector, that the position of finance, the ability of a few people to sit on extraordinary concentrations of money, has given them power and importance at the federal level with presidents, made presidents rely on them and they to rely on the presidents to create this partnership. Is that the case? Is this really a long-standing situation that whoever the president is, he or she has to enter into that partnership because they couldn't govern otherwise since this is so structurally a part of our economy?
Yes, except it's not even a question of they couldn't govern. They wouldn't govern. There's an alignment not just of the partnership, but also the philosophies that each component of that partnership, a president or a banker, brings to the partnership. And how it manifests is different ways depending on the direction of the country, who's in leadership, which bankers are in leadership positions in their banks, and so forth. So it certainly goes back to, and that's why I mentioned the concept of J.P. Morgan and Teddy Roosevelt. J.P. Morgan also, going forward with the Roosevelts, created, for example, the Metropolitan Club of New York, which was a very elite, old, prestigious club where industrialists and financiers and future presidents or their sons would gather to discuss matters of political and financial and American expansionary importance. This is where they hung out. Government was done in the hands of a very few people. Now, the money trusts at the time that Morgan was ahead of and what they were called back in the day were something that concentrated that wealth in a lot of different financial services, but across different types of companies, across insurance companies, across commercial banks, across private banks, investment banks, and the individuals that ran those tended to be related to each other or got married to each other for the first really half of the 20th century. So James Stillman, who I mentioned before, who was the head of National City Bank, had two daughters. They married two sons who were John D. Rockefeller's sons. They produced a Stillman Rockefeller. The Stillman Rockefeller was the head of what became National City Bank, Citibank in the mid-50s to early 60s. There were really four families that concentrated the political and financial wealth amongst them for the first 60 to 70 years, really, in the United States. It's dispersed a bit since then. Other people, you know, they've died off, other people have come in, things have changed, they've become less personal. But that concentration of power within those families was very, very tight throughout the top three banks, and that in turn was very tight with most of the men who also were president. And it started like in childhood in some cases, or in college in other cases.
So the intertwining of business, power, and family that Americans, for example, might associate with films like The Godfather are actually applicable far beyond The Godfather. There are even lines I remember in The Godfather film where one of the key players says, "We're really no different from the senators and the bankers. They're in a bigger business than ours, but it's the same basic model." Is that the fruit of your research as well?
That's a lot of it, and it operates in a similar way. The difference, to some extent, between presidents and presidents of banks and the way the sort of families have interacted, particularly in the first many decades of the last century, is that presidents do have to deal with an election, whereas the men that ran the major banks in the country that all still exist today, all the six banks that were in that room in 1929, all the installations and constellations of the J.P. Morgan banks in the 1900s, they all still exist. They did fine. They didn't die. The ascension in those banks, it was more like a monarchy. You know, you didn't have an outside election for those people. So in a lot of cases, there would be a banker. For example, Winthrop Aldrich, who was the head of Chase for almost two decades, that really interacted with several presidents along the way. And when I say interacted, I mean worked with them, was called into the White House, was asked for advice, gave advice, hung out with, yachted with, the whole thing. Whereas, you know, presidents had to deal with things like campaigns. And so the timings were a bit different, and one was elected and one was more appointed. But the intertwinement and the operation was a lot closer than I think those who believe that this power has just come about recently think. And because of that closeness, we have what we have more recently. We have the concentration of wealth and financial and political power today because we've had it, and it's been built up philosophically for so long. The difference is today there's more capital involved. There's more leverage involved. It's more dangerous. And the personal relationships are actually less important in terms of a genteel kind of character manner. And they're much more functional, and they're much more involving, you know, lobbyists and lawyers and all sorts of people in between the relationship. So the color has changed.
We're going to take our mid-program break, as we always do. I'm talking with Nomi Prince. We're going to return and continue this interview in a very short time. Please stay with us.
I love you, 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 for sentimental reasons. I hope you do believe me. I've given you my, given you my heart because I'm you, and you alone were meant for me. Please give your loving heart to me and say we'll never part.
Welcome back, folks. We are ready to continue our program and to continue our interview. Once again, I am Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. I want to remind you again of the two websites where you can follow and see all of our programs. By the way, are archived on both these websites and available to you if you want to listen to them. rdwolff2fs.com and democracyatwork.info. And my guest again is Nomi Prince, a former banker with Goldman Sachs, Bear Stearns, a prolific author and writer. Since this is a tax time in our country, and since we were talking about taxes earlier, tell me what might be a way of understanding, with your historical view, the relationship between banks and the financial tip of the iceberg, their peak, let's call it, of that industry, and what's happened to taxes in the United States?
Yeah, it was interesting when you were talking about the beginning part of the show about how the balance between corporate taxes and personal income taxes was much more even back in the 50s and the 60s. It just reminded me there's a part in my book where I noticed at the Eisenhower Libraries that Morgan partner named George Whitney, who had been around during the crash, he was a sort of junior partner at the time and sort of grown up through it. He'd been at the PCORA hearings where all sorts of crimes of Wall Street were exposed. But he was also a progressive banker. He was friends with Eisenhower. They had a golf love and all sorts of other connections. And he was kind of an unofficial advisor to Eisenhower. And when Eisenhower was considering this tax shift, he basically wrote to Eisenhower and said, look, a few dollars in the hands of someone at the lower or middle part of this country means much more for our country than a few dollars in the hands of a company man. You know, language was a little bit different than that. But I say the quotes in my book, it's something like that. And the idea being that here was a person who was wealthy, who had made his wealth out of financial capital and betting as well, not to the extent that they do today, realized that for the betterment of the country, it would be useful to not overburden the citizens and shift back away from supporting the general population into supporting people that already had it and they're already doing better off. So, and Eisenhower actually listened to that. Some of the tax decisions that were made were actually based on this behind-the-scenes person. Of course, he had a lot of very different types of individuals coming in who sort of weren't from the family backgrounds, who were coming in and talking about how they specifically should reduce the taxes on the corporations and shift back. But there was still a pushback. There was still a no. There's accountability that Eisenhower's government, that Truman's government, that LBJ, through LBJ, through Kennedy, had with respect to bankers, with respect to those individuals that said, we'll stay away from how you operate your bank. And we have big regulations with the Glass-Steagall Act in 1933. We split up the bets from the real activities that you do with individuals. We won't put too much regulation in your way, but you guys got to play with us too. And so what we're going to do is for the better, for the public interest, from our economic policy perspective, domestically, and you have to play ball. We need something from you. LBJ did this as well. He pushed through his Great Society, and he was very good at using people, an excellent politician. He used some of the bankers of his day who would otherwise have been very negative at that point because things were changing. Things were getting a little bit more me, the whole Mad Men era. But he was from an old era, and he said, no, I'll stay out of your way. You got to help me. I need you to not say anything negative about my plans. In fact, I need you to talk to your friends in the Senate and so forth and make sure you help me get done what I need to get done to help America, and I will also help you. That whole notion has disintegrated.
Tell me a little bit about how all of this shifted in the 1970s. How did we make the shift from both a cozy relationship that was intimate then to what we have today, and how did we shift from bankers who were willing to cut these kinds of deals with presidents to help them be more fair, more equal in the burden of taxation, for example, in exchange for letting them have their own way of making money? How did it all change and why over the last 30, 40 years?
Yeah, so also in that period, the background thing that was happening was we were fighting a Cold War. So the bankers also had military protection in the countries outside of the United States into which they wanted to expand branches and expand their business internationally. And that was supported on a military basis. So that was another way it was symbiotic during that period outside of taxes. But that also showed them, particularly David Rockefeller, who was rising to the head of Chase in the late 60s. He became chairman in 1969 through the early 80s. Walter Wriston, who became head of National Citibank just slightly after David Rockefeller became head of Chase. Those men really wanted to expand internationally. And one of the things that they found that would help them do that without the tie to having to sort of toe whatever patriotic line there might be on the other side was oil in the Middle East. And what happened was they were going after branching out in the Middle East because it was plush with oil. they were pushing the conversion or the recycling, they called it, of petrodollars into Latin American debt. And this became a tremendous opportunity for them to work completely outside of whatever American policy might be domestically and make money internationally and not even actually pay taxes on it in a lot of extents. There was, the books were very bad that time and sort of moving all of that money around. So as a result, their international profitability just skyrocketed and they realized that they don't really need this kind of alignment. That was coupled with the fact that Nixon and Rockefeller and Risden didn't really get along so well on a personal basis. Nixon didn't get along with a lot of people on a personal basis, but he got along enough to ask each one of them to be his secretary, his Treasury Secretary at various points in his administration, but he didn't ask them personally. And so both of them rejected him and were annoyed that he hadn't even bothered to do the kinds of things that LBJ had done or FDR had done, which was invite them and hang out and stroke them and everything else. He didn't do any of that. So between the oil and Latin America and just the sort of frostiness of Nixon and the lack of trust between those two groups of people, things started to disintegrate. And then they just started to move away and away from any sort of alignment, although the connections were still there. They weren't as personal and they weren't as useful to the general public.
I want to hone in on two final points where I need your comment. I'm often asked in this program and where I speak around the country about the Federal Reserve. Is it really a government agency or is it a creature of the banks? Does it have any real power? What's it there for? Tell us, you've researched 100 years, which is really the lifetime of the Federal Reserve, 100 years of banks and politics. How do you understand the Federal Reserve?
First of all, the Federal Reserve was created, pretty much the theme of my book, by a political and financial alliance. It was created for the most part because of bankers, for bankers, and by bankers. But it was also created because Washington wanted to have a way of expanding the dollar and its currency throughout the world. And politically, after Teddy Roosevelt, when Taft came in as president, he truly believed that to have any sort of international power, he needed a central bank to compete with creating the currencies of central banks like the Bank of England and so forth. So he sent Senator Nelson Aldrich, who was one of the main big political financial families in this country, to a fact-finding mission in Europe. He took James Stillman with him, who I mentioned before, from National City Bank. So it was a senator and a banker. They were off gallivanting in Europe. They got reports. They sent stuff back in. They talked. But nothing was really confirmed in terms of an act. And then in November of 1910, J.P. Morgan was actually getting a little antsy about this. He had thought that he had saved New York and the world in the panic of 1907, even though he used other people's money to do it, and he thought that we needed a bank to back him. So the bankers wanted a bank to back them. The government wanted a bank to expand itself internationally. So they both wanted the same thing, and they both worked together to do it. But the meeting that occurred in 1910 in Jekyll Island, which was where the original idea for the Fed was born, was a meeting at which Senator Aldrich came with one of his assistant treasury, treasury secretary, so two people from Washington, and four bankers. And the bankers represented the Morgan Bank and the National City Bank. Those were the four bankers that were there. And after they spent 10 days there talking about stuff, banging out the plans, shooting pheasants, eating Thanksgiving meals, having a very isolated time. And I went down to Jekyll Island. You can imagine how isolated it was back then. Now it has sort of a causeway to it. But then people came in by boat. It was secret. You had to be signed in by a member. And the member was J.P. Morgan. He wasn't at the meeting. None of those men had a membership. None of them could have been at that island. It was all sponsored by him, which was something I discovered from looking at the records of Jekyll Island when I was there. They come back. They have to go to Washington and present this. Aldrich has to go to Washington because he's the senator. And he actually had gotten hit by a trolley car on Madison Avenue before all this event. And so he was not feeling very well at this point. So two bankers who were at that meeting went to Washington to present the plan. So 3 years later, this plan evolves. All the same people involved. One of the guys who presented it, Frank Vanderlip, who was a number two at National City Bank, was a friend of Woodrow Wilson before when Woodrow Wilson was the head of Princeton. He had helped finance Princeton and some of the Princeton interests. So there was a tight connection there. And when the Federal Reserve Act was finally signed in the December 1913 by Woodrow Wilson, it was very similar to the plan that was hatched by these four bankers and two people from Washington. And as a caveat to that, I know we're running out of time, but I just found this fascinating, the history, is that Nelson Aldrich's son Winthrop Aldrich was the chairman of Chase during FDR's time and for two decades afterwards. And Winthrop Aldrich's nephew, one was David Rockefeller, who became another chairman of Chase, and another one was Nelson Rockefeller, who became a four-time governor of New York and the vice president. So, again, these lines are pretty deep.
Yeah, it's remarkable. A final thought. What's left of the notion of democracy? Clearly, the bankers at the top make all the key decisions. They're not governed by the bankers or the employees of the banks they serve. There's no democracy inside the financial sector. And yes, the president has to run for office, but it sounds like, at the very least, a disproportionate amount of power is wielded by big bankers in shaping what happens in the political arena, which at least compromises, if it doesn't nullify, whatever democracy occurs in politics. How would you change all of this? What is it you've learned that you can teach our audience about the cozy intimacy between bankers and presidents that might, especially now that we live in an economic system that seems so compromised by what they did, how would it change? How do you envision the possibility or the directions that change could take or should take?
Well, right now we have more concentrated power in terms of the sheer capital that these banks, the big six banks today that were mostly legacy banks of those banks over time, they survived all of the panics and crises and wars in between to be very, very healthy. They control 85% of the FDIC insured assets. They control 96% of all of the derivatives that any financial institution creates today. So they're tremendously powerful in terms of the capital that they command relative to any period of time in history. In addition, they have had more subsidies since the crash or the crisis of 2008 from the Federal Reserve, who was holding $4.2 trillion worth of their securities and debt on the books in order to help them, who has zero interest rate policies in order to help them. And a President Obama who has done nothing but pretend that the Reform Act, in quotes, that was the Dodd-Frank Act, has done anything to alter the potential of risk that there is because of this concentration of power. So democracy is about the spreading out of power. It's about choice in power. It's about the direction, in its utopian sense, the direction that a country can go based on one person, one vote, based on one idea, one human, based on everybody being collected. We don't have that in America, and we haven't had that. One of the things that my book shows, but by nature of the consolidation and concentration of power relationships at the political and financial level, and all the points in between, shows that we don't have that. How do we change that? I mean, a lot more people have to be a lot more aware of what's going on. We at least had a situation in the 30s with FDR and a banker, Winthrop Aldrich, who managed to get together, and both of them supported the Glass-Steagall Act, which at least separated the
commercial
risk
from the investments.
From the investments. It took our risk out of the equation of the bank's bet. So the powerful political alignment at least wasn't against the American population. But there's a lot of things like that from a legislative perspective need to happen. But for that to happen, you need better leadership who can actually stand up to a president who can stand up to the bankers and not believe that everything that will happen will be horrific if he doesn't or if she doesn't, and bankers that have to be held accountable for what they do. We've had periods in our time in history where that's been better balanced. Now is not one of those times. So we can also look to history for a better guide to how to have a fairer democracy and balance of power in the future. And we have to, because it's not going to get better.
Thank you very much, Nobi. I appreciate your spending this time with us. I want everyone to take a look at All the President's Bankers, Nomi Prince, P-R-I-N-S, to get an understanding of the long-standing, intimate family connection between our presidents and our bankers, because it'll help you understand where that situation is now, the problems it poses, the opportunities it provides. This is an important piece of work, and it's a way of following what we do on this program, even after the programs themselves are over. Thanks again, Naomi, for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks, Rick.
In the remaining time that we have, I want to deal with questions. And in fact, I'm going to focus on one question because It's a one that comes to us fairly often. It's one that I can answer in some detail, and it raises some really interesting points that we can make. Here's the question. Can you explain the difference between what the people of America want, on the one hand, in the realm of economics particularly, and what the politicians are actually doing? And I thought the way to answer this question was to give you the results of some recent polling in the last month or two. And I'm going to tell you what the result is and where the poll and which poll was done, and then we're going to see what it means as my way of answering this question. Okay, on the question of poverty in America that a lot of people are thinking about as so many of us enter that condition, the Bloomberg Financial Service did a poll and found that across the United States, randomly selected individuals, 69% favor raising the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour from the current $7.25. 69% favor raising the minimum wage, an overwhelming majority, more than two-thirds of our people. Next, on poverty, just two of them on poverty. 54% favor raising taxes on the wealthy and corporations to expand programs for the poor. This was a poll conducted by USA Today in cooperation with the Pew Research Center. It's a major polling institution in the United States, and USA Today is our closest we have to a national newspaper. So here are clear majorities for doing something about poverty. Let me give you the next example on inequality. The first poll, again done by USA Today and the Pew Research Center. 60% of Americans, randomly selected, believe that the economic system in this country unfairly favors the wealthy. Unfairly favors the wealthy. Next poll on inequality, also again USA Today and the Pew Research Center. 69% think that the government should act to reduce the gap between the rich and everyone else. Third and final topic of the polling about what Americans want. This one has to do with politics. The first result is from the firm Represent Us. And in cooperation, they conducted a poll with the M4 Market Research Outfit and the Tulchin, T-U-L-C-H-I-N, Research Outfit. These are respected, well-known, established polling institutions. Ready? 97% of Americans polled would support a federal law that imposes tough new anti-corruption laws for politicians, lobbyists, and super PACs. 97%. Be hard-pressed to get 97% of Americans to agree on hardly anything. Final poll on politics. This one conducted by CNN and the ORC polling outfit. 69% think that the policies of the Republican Party generally favor the rich. Okay, why did I present these and select these? Because I think they show an overwhelming support among the American people for a host of changes to the conditions we have today, and about which I can say that the politicians in this country, with some exceptions, systematically refuse to do what these polls show they ought to do if they were responsive to the will of the people. There really is no way out of this conclusion. President Obama, who does favor an increase in the minimum wage to $10.10, is having a very difficult time moving that plan forward, and most observers in Washington think he will fail. He won't get it. And even if he does, it's a remarkable thing that it's a long and difficult slog if, as the Bloomberg Financial Service reports, 69%, 7 out of 10 Americans, support raising the minimum wage. Why would it not be anything than a slam dunk in the halls of our Congress? How could they dare, these congressmen and women, not vote for raising the minimum wage to $10.10 if 7 out of 10 of their constituents want that? And 54% of Americans favor raising taxes on wealthy and corporations to expand programs for the poor. That has exactly zero chance of anything like that happening in the Senate or the House of Representatives. So it'll never get to the office of the president for his signature, such an idea. A clear majority, 54% is more than most people need to win the presidency of the United States. But 54% of Americans who want that will not see it in this Congress. Wow. 60% believe the economic system in this country unfairly favors the wealthy. You won't hear that said very often in the halls of Congress. 69% of the government think that the government should act to reduce the gap between rich and everyone else. Wow. The obvious way to do that, given our history, would be to raise the income tax the highest rate on the richest people, from the 39% it is now, back to the 70, 80, and 90% it was in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Not only is that not on the docket in the Congress, they don't even discuss it. If you see them discussing taxes, it's as if those rates never happened. Bottom line here is clear. We're governed by a political community that is much more responsive to somebody else than it is responsive to what the clear majority view of the people is. And you all know what the answer here is. Because a couple of weeks ago, the Supreme Court made another decision, allowing wealthy people to throw their money around without limits to influence political parties, political candidates, and political elections. The reality is that presidents, senators, congressmen and women, at the state level, the same thing, they're responsive to the money that makes their careers and their campaigns possible. They have to do what the money wants, and they can safely ignore what the people want, as my reporting to you of the results of these polls amply show. That has to be changed if we don't want a continuation of the economic declines and crises that we have been living through. I want to thank Nomi Prince again for being with me. I want to thank you for all your time and your attention in following me on these programs. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update, and I look forward to being with you again next week. Thank you.